Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Commonwealth Clubs and Forum, Connect Your Intellect, with a mission to inspire and debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.com/inform. I'm Ryan Flynn, reporter with Bloomberg News. Now, tonight we're going to be looking at the world of urban winemaking. We're seeing more wineries popping up in cities instead of rural areas, and we have some fabulous panelists to talk about why that's happening tonight and sort of what the future that will hold. We have a great group. We're joined by Jim Morosky, who's co-founder and owner of Treasure Island Wines, Derek Rolfs, proprietor and winemaker of Bravium, Sasha Verengay, a winemaker at Enno Wines, and Catherine Cohen of Stomping Girl Wines. So let's get started. One of the things I find most fascinating as a person who covers wine on occasion is the wonderful stories that propel people to make wine. A lot of them come from various industries, and how they get to where they are is always really interesting. So let's start with that. Jim, you want to talk about how you got into making wine?
Sure. Thank you very much, Ryan. So welcome, everybody. And so to begin on how I got started in the wine business is the other business that I was in for 18 years, and I still am to some extent, is internet security. Now, what does that got to do with winemaking? I was looking for something that I could get my hands dirty and less intellectual, less sort of intangible. And my brother and I started making wine probably 10, 11, 12 years ago in a garage, and then slowly kind of started building it up. We started looking at making some wine at some other facilities and started to do that. But frankly, the garage winemaking sort of got out of hand, and my wife can tell you that at some point we were stretching the envelope of what we technically could make in a garage, and the winemakers up here know what I'm talking about. So at that point, actually one thing happened to me that influenced me a lot was, I met Robert Rex, who is now the winemaker proprietor at Deerfield Creek up in Sonoma. He was a former professor at Berkeley, my alma mater, and I met him at a winemaker's dinner, and he started out the same way I did. And frankly, again, I remember that day very well. He encouraged me to continue to follow my dream and start doing wine the way I like to do it, which is small batch, artisanal, and really sort of old world kind of style wines. My brother and I looked around for a place to start making some wine. There is some places that you can do sort of small batches and as contractor or what's a concept called alternating proprietorships up in Napa and Sonoma. But there's no place to do it in San Francisco. I live in San Carlos of all places. So the issue at this point was we started looking around and make a long story short, I stumbled upon Treasure Island, the former Navy base that's just on the other side of the bay, in the middle of the bay. And I found the former food processing plant PX, which is the store on the base, that is ideal for winemaking. We're surrounded by 55 to 60 degree water all year round. It's cool. It has this great drain floor with red tile things. It was just sitting there being unused. And skipping over a lot of things, the city originally said when we went to them and said we want to start a winery on Treasure Island, the former Navy base, they kind of looked at me like I was nuts. And it took about 6 months of diligent work, some politicking and working to open up the first winery on Treasure Island in 2007. And with that, we slowly built up. We had 10,000 square feet winery. Last year we did total of about 6,000, actually we did 8,000 case equivalent, but we bottled about 4,000 to 5,000 cases. So it's not actually among several winemakers. And they're after me. My time's up. Is that the time there?
Yeah.
So the reality is that we've now, Treasure Island Wine is a collective of four wineries, including myself, that we share the facility. So with that, I'll turn it over to Derek.
So Derek, how did you get involved in winemaking?
So I wish I could say I grew up on a vineyard up in Sonoma or Napa. Or I was just born into it.
Don't we all?
Yeah, right. But I grew up in a family where the only wine that was consumed at the dinner table might be like Matus or something with a strawberry or a hill or
was there
something
straw
like that
on the on the bottle?
Yeah, maybe a little straw. Okay. When we went out for fancy dinners,
nice.
Maybe. Yeah. So I didn't have a family background in wine. With that, I'll fast forward to my college days, just to kind of touch on a few things. I was an environmental studies major at UC Santa Barbara, So I decided early on that I liked being outdoors and I liked getting my hands dirty. And right when I got out of school, I, of course, parlayed that environmental studies degree into a marketing career, specifically. Makes sense, right?
Yeah. Of course.
So specifically casino marketing. And so I makes sense as well, right? That was a family business, actually. So I traveled around the country. In working at casinos, you get to go to a lot of fancy events and fundraisers, charity events. And what do they always have at those events? They have really great wine. So I was exposed to a lot of wine. I have a little bit of an obsessive personality. When I find something I like to know as much as I can about it. So I started reading books and drinking more wine, which I encourage you all to do. Best way to learn about it is to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And basically ended up back in California about 10 years ago with a marketing company and precious little spare time. Thankfully for me, right across the street from my day job was a custom crush facility. And I decided, hey, I'm going to walk across and meet these guys and see if I might be able to make a little wine. I was just doing it for fun, nights and weekends, giving it away at the holidays to family and friends. Eventually, family and friends start asking if they can have more. And when you make it a barrel at a time, there's not much to go around. So after selling the marketing company in 2008, having a little more free time, I decided to turn that out-of-control hobby into a commercial venture, and have been at it since. And I upgraded from that custom crush facility to Treasure Island Wines, where I'm part of the collective. And thank you, Jim, for finding such great space for us to make wine, being a trailblazer over there. And so, yeah, out-of-control hobby. I didn't have a garage to make wine out of because I lived in a condo. So I'm technically not a garage winemaker, but, yeah, from humble beginnings.
So, Sasha, sorry for murdering your last name, but do you want to tell us your background story?
Sure. So, Sasha Verhaeghe with Eno Wines, and I fell into wine by accident. I grew up in Michigan and went to school out there and got what I call an informal degree in drinking beer. That's what they drink a lot of in Michigan. And if there is any wine, it's in straws or it's with strawberries or it's grown in Traverse City, which is improving, which is good. So I came out to California to pursue my passion, which involves high tech. I came here in 96. I got an internship and then a job at Broderbund Software in Novato. And around September time frame, my boss turns to me and said, you know, you're a young buck. Looks like you can carry a lot. My dad's been making wine for 35 years. He's an amazing winemaker. He needs someone strong like you. You want to wake up at 4 in the morning and go up to Napa Valley with him? I was like, sure. So for me at the time, good wine was cheap wine. So $4.99 was perfect. I was like, oh, great, I'm going to splurge tonight, $5.99, get ready to go up to Napa tomorrow, right? So went up with him, and he turned out to be a walking encyclopedia. He was trained as an architect at Harvard and Yale, and I call him the white James Earl Jones, because when he talks, it's like the voice of God. And so when we're driving up to Napa, even though it's 4:30 in the morning and I hadn't had my cup of coffee, he's telling me about degree days, clones, terroir, Sonoma versus Napa. And I'm like, really? Wow. You know, I'm writing in my notebook. So it was great because my homework ended up being good bottles of wine. So he would set me off with a case of wine and say, I want you to report next week on what you thought of all these wines. And so suddenly I went from those $5.99 bottles of Cabernet to the $59 bottles. And it was a great leap. So shortly thereafter, I had my epiphany wines or my light bulb wines that really sparked the interest for me and said, wow, there's some amazing things just an hour and a half away from San Francisco, which is where I lived at the time. Got the bug, started making some, and we didn't have a garage either, but in our lanai in Coal Valley, which was nice and air-conditioned naturally. And, fast forward a couple years of apprenticing under him, I came across another winemaker who opened up a place in Berkeley, and I became his assistant winemaker during the dot-com crash. So in 2001, did that, and sort of the passion became one of my primary things, and I became a bonded winery in 2002 and have been working in the facility in Berkeley ever since. Fortunately or unfortunately, I have a day job in high tech. I work at Google. It's pretty demanding. I also have a 4-year-old daughter that has also its own time requirements. But these are all things that I love to do, and that's why I'm here, to share that passion with you.
Catherine, how about you?
Catherine Cohen with Stomping Go Wines. My husband and I work side by side at the winery. He actually grew up in Israel with his grandmother making wine for the village where he lived, and has vivid memories of his little sister getting in the barrel, stomping the grapes. They didn't have any formal equipment to do that work, so he was employed to harvest the grapes. She stomped them, and their grandmother made the wine. So we sort of rekindled that family tradition in 2003. We were in France visiting his other half of the family in Burgundy doing some wine tasting and decided, hey, we can go back and do this. So we came back to Berkeley and started making wine in our crawl space under our house where literally you couldn't stand up. Started with carboys, a couple hundred pounds of grapes, and grew every year. Friends joined us and loved the wine and loved helping out at harvest and bottling and corking and all those fun activities. We pretty much doubled production every year in our little basement and ended up remodeling, making an expensive basement under our house where we could make more wine. And as more and more people got involved and asked where they could buy our wine, we decided to go commercial in 2008. And we looked at various places to make wine and didn't have the financial resources to do it all the way in Napa or Sonoma. So we decided it had worked for a while in our basement in an urban setting, and why not continue it on a commercial level in an urban setting where we could stay in our community and keep our kids in school where they were and work in this environment. So that was 2008, and we're still making wine in Berkeley.
You know, one of the great things about having urban wineries is that if you live in a city, it's easy access. You don't have to drive, an hour or two to Napa or Sonoma and sit in traffic. But maybe on the other side of things, you don't have the cachet of the bucolic setting with the vineyards. But tell me a little bit about what's your view on the benefits and sort of the drawbacks of being in the city. Can you not charge as much as someone in Napa because you don't have a $100 million property behind you, or do you get to experiment with different varietals because you can buy from whatever? Do you want to say take that one, Sasha, to start off?
Sure. I like living in the East Bay. I love the Bay Area, and that's my pot of soil. Fortunately, grapes grow in other pots of soil like Napa and Sonoma, and they're conveniently only an hour and a half, 2 hours away. If you're in the Bay Area, you can make wine from the Sierra foothills, which you can get there also in 2 hours. You can make it in Monterey, San Lucia Highlands, 2 hours. It's a common thread. Maybe I've made Viognier from Santa Barbara. That's a little bit of a drive, but it's a beautiful drive. So I really like to be where I want to be, and the grapes can grow where they grow best. And it's this mutual beneficial thing that I think is that lends itself for people to show up at the winery very casually. We're not about suits. We're far more blue jeans, a little more Sonoma, and we're really close to great food. So a lot of those restaurants are really interested in what we're up to, and they always come forward and say, we really want cases of your wine, or we want to have an East Bay Vintners event or something like that. So there's a very strong community, which I don't think you necessarily get, or it's a different type of community in Napa and Sonoma. But
yeah, so on that point, Catherine, this was the last weekend. There was East Bay Vintners Alliance, East Bay Wine Trail Passport Weekend. Talk a little bit about the crowds you saw there. Who's a typical urban winery customer? Who comes to these kind of things?
Right. Well, I agree with a lot of what Sasha said, but in addition to those, I found one of the benefits to being an urban winery is the great diversity in the customers and the crowds we see at tasting events, all ethnicities, all races, all economic backgrounds. That when I've made trips up to Napa and Sonoma tasting rooms, I certainly don't see. So I just love having the... It's mostly, not necessarily, but a lot of young people who perhaps are new to wine tasting, it's less intimidating to go to an urban winery, I think, than to walk up to a big chateau in Napa where there might be rules you have to follow. Mm. Here it's just about having fun and tasting wine, which happens to be great, well-made wine as mm-hmm. well, but not as intimidating, yeah. I think.
As you do marketing for your wine, Derek, is it hard to be taken seriously if you don't have, you know, the Napa brand sort of on your label? Is that a difficult right. part of the process?
Yeah, so we don't have the brand that has a Napa or Sonoma location. We keep picking on Napa and Sonoma or complimenting them, I guess, in a backhanded way by referring to them like that. But I think the thing I realized early on that I would add to the discussion here is that there are a lot of great farmers up in, like, when you go up to Napa and you drive around, you automatically almost assume, I think, when you first start going to Napa, that these are all estate vineyards that are attached in some way to these beautiful wineries and these amazing tasting rooms, you know? And the reality is, even in Napa, there are farmers and that have been there for generations, or families that have been there for generations that don't make wine or don't have their own estate winery. But they do sell their fruit. And so to Sasha's point, I mean, some of the fruit we bring in from Carneros, if we bring it in, we pick it early enough in the morning, we truck it down and don't hit any traffic, you know, it can be to us quicker than it could be to the north part of Napa Valley. Mm-hmm. So there's no degradation in the fruit. And once you get the grape in the winery, it's all the same. So I think from a marketing standpoint, to answer your question, some of our wine does have a Napa Valley or a Sonoma or a Paso Robles or Santa Lucia Highlands appellation on it. And I think that helps because a lot of people gravitate towards certain appellations. And that's important, I think, when you're getting started. Mm-hmm. But from a branding standpoint, and I am a marketing person, I think you can overcome that in other ways.
You make up a good point. There's a general misconception that most wineries, you know, in the countryside are attached to certain vineyards. And the reality is there are a lot of so-called virtual wines, labels that basically have been around for a while that buy fruit from somewhere else. Can you talk a little bit about that, Jim? I mean, how do you differentiate yourself from that?
Well, I mean, you know, again, we all are working wineries. We're actually making the wine. We're getting our hands dirty and we're doing that. So, as opposed to something that's a more of a contract relationship where somebody is contracting another winery to make the wine on their behalf and along their profile and what they want to do. So essentially, in terms of going back to the marketing piece, I think what is interesting about what we do as urban wineries is that I think it's interesting, consistent thread through what we all said was, when you come to an urban winery, you're going to meet one of us. You're going to talk to one of us. Mm-hmm. You're going to meet the winemaker. You're going to meet us. We know where the fruit comes from. We walk the vineyards. We know exactly where things, and we can give you a story behind it. It's a little bit more in a personal story and a personal connection than you would get at, let's say, at the more larger mid-sized wineries up in Napa and Sonoma that are more, let's say, on the beaten track. So we give a little bit more personal experience to it, and we are a winery no different than what you would find in any of the other major wine regions. It just so happens we bring in fruit from all over the state, and we can pick and choose the great vineyards that we like and we want to experiment with.
So you have more freedom to kind of play around different stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think, you know, I think all of us here are probably examples of we're trying different varietals. We're trying different fruit. This last year I brought in some really incredible Roussanne from Amador County, of all places. Got it into the winery within 2 hours. I would have got there sooner if I didn't hit some traffic, but that was really the issue. And that's what's great. And it's all small batch stuff, very, very unique kind of stuff that you typically won't find in some other wineries because we can try to do it at an economic basis, but trying to keep it a reasonable price level for the consumer.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things that a lot of the wineries talk about in Napa and Sonoma is that they have relationships with growers for generations, and it sometimes can be hard to get contracts for some of the best plots, but it doesn't mean those always the best wines. Derek, want to talk a little bit about some of the wineries, some of the grape growers you work with and why that you like their stuff?
Yeah, I mentioned the families and the generations that have been there. There really is a huge part of credit needs to go to the wine growers as they're, you know, the people that are growing the wine in the vineyards. Because in becoming a winemaker and learning how to craft wine once you get the grapes into the winery, you're humbled really quickly when you go walk through the vineyards with someone who grew up on the vineyard and can tell you everything about the fruit and the soil and the weather and some of the bad weather things that could befall things if we let the fruit hang out for another couple weeks. So it is that relationship with the growers is so important, and working with great growers is important. At my winery, just to tell a quick story how we're structured, we have basically Bravium, which is my flagship brand, and we take after we've vetted growers and vetted vineyards, we basically move them up to the major league, so to speak, from my perspective. And some of the newer relationships I have, or the new vineyards I'm working with, I have what I call my artisanal brands that are some of those you all will hopefully enjoy after the talk today. So I have the flexibility again to work with new growers in different locations. Mm. So I kind of feel like it's a little bit the best of both worlds. At the time I started the winery, I didn't have the time, the money, or the inclination to just commit to one vineyard location with, you know, one or two or three varietals that I was growing in that one location. Mm-hmm. I wanted to play around. I wanted to take a shotgun approach. And maybe when I grow up and I'm older and wiser, I'll commit mm-hmm. to a plot of land, or you know, as Sasha mentioned earlier. So.
Yeah, Sasha, what's your sort of experience with grape buying? And, you know, how do you kind of approach the market? What do you look for? Do you look for particular names or varietals? Mm-hmm. What's your approach?
Well, I think the common thread you hear with all of us is that there's passion. There's a lot of passion, and we're first generation. It's not like it's been in the family forever and we've been born into this family. It all starts with a passion. We have different careers, and we're motivated by that. And I think passion is fueled by our palates, what we're tasting, and what we're tasting in wine, and the mystery behind that, and the intrigue, and trying to get into the soul of that wine. And so I only make wines that I like to make and I like to drink, because if no one else likes it, guess what? I'm having a big party and it's going to be awesome.
You
right?
can invite me if you want, but I'll come over.
Yeah. I don't make it for a certain market. I was like, oh, this varietal is really hot right now. Let me ride Pinot Noir. Like, my light bulb wine was Pinot Noir. And then, you know, Sideways came out years later and obviously impacted our sales significantly because of it and the interest in Pinot Noir. But the question around how do I find vineyards is, I start with my own palate. I say, I really like Pinot Noir. Let me taste as many Pinot Noirs as I can. So I'll go to a great wine shop or go on a wine trip, go to Santa Barbara, let's say, fill up a case of Pinot Noir, and then really dial it in and say, you know what, I like Russian River better than I like Carneros because, and then I'll be able to complete the sentence. Mm-hmm. And then you say, I like Russian River, then you start dialing it in, like, how close to the ocean do I like? Do I like it on this side, what clones? And then you start to really geek out. And then, you know, you buy another case and you fine-tune. And then before you know it, you say, I really like Zinfandel. In my case, that was one of my favorites at first. I really like Zinfandel from Dry Creek, and I like Ray Teldesky's Zinfandel. Mike Officer from Carlisle was making it. I was like, oh my gosh, and also one of my wine mentors. And so I went up there one afternoon with my mentor, totally fired up, asking a million questions, and guess who shows up at the Patriarch, who's 95 years old, and he's like, let me walk you through the vineyard. And he has vines that are 120 years old, and he'll tell you stories about each and every one of them. Like, he has names for them. He's like, you know, when Ray was 14 trying to learn an ATV, he ran right through them, and I couldn't talk to him for a week and a half. Like, you know, so he's really connected to that. And he could feel my passion, and he said, well, this year I'll give you a little bit of grapes. So he gave me the 20-year-old vines. And then I did that for about 2 years, and then I graduated, and he said, now you get the real stuff. Now you get the 120-year-old. Vines. So
it's still relationship-based then, really.
It's very much mm-hmm. relationship-based, and they feel the passion, and there's like a little dating period, you know? Because sometimes it doesn't really work. I mean, to be honest, you know, some people are like, we want to give you, you know, they're in it for the profits, mm-hmm. but there are other folks who are like, well, my name, if it's a single vineyard designate, is also on that label, so I better do a good job if it's Fairview Road Ranch or Pizzoni or whatever it may be, to build their own brand as a vineyard. So there's a symbiotic thing.
So Catherine, for you, how's your dating experience been with the grape growers? Do you find that it helps to have better established vineyards on your label? Do you like doing regional varietals?
Well, you know, we like to vet the appellation and the vineyard. We try to taste other wineries that have made wine from these grapes and walk through the vineyards as much as we can. But once we've gotten to the point where all of that is acceptable, yeah, it really does come down to relationships. And I mean, we work with three really great growers right now. We have for the last few years, and we hope to continue that relationship. It's great to be able to work directly with the farmer, the owner, the one that's doing all the work. And like you say, they know their vines very intimately. They know which rows, you know, will ripen first, which ones you need to hold back on before harvest. And, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's really great to be able to work directly with, with the farmer and the grower.
And in terms of sales, most of you, what's your general case production like? You're at 500, you said, Catherine?
We're about 500 cases.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Sasha, what are you?
Yeah, anywhere from 200 to 500, okay, depending on the year.
Derek?
Yeah, with Bravium, we're doing, Bravium and the Independence, we're doing about 600 cases, and then we do some other production as well.
And, and Derek's being modest here because he actually does quite a bit more than that on some of the other stuff, but I'm doing about 1,000
okay.
right now.
So at those levels, how do you get your wines in the market? Do you have mailing lists only? Do you try to approach local restaurants? Do you have setups at the bars where you say, hey, look, we'll give you a keg and you can do our wine by the tap? I mean, Jim, what's your approach to the market?
Right now.
It's actually happening.
Right now. What I'm doing and focusing on is primarily a few selected restaurant channels and also the tasting room that we have on Treasure Island and direct. Mm-hmm. It seems to be our best way to go out there. Getting into other channels requires investment and also a scale that, frankly, again, can be hard on a small winery. But I'll let these other folks say something about that.
Derek, how about you?
Yeah, the restaurants for sure. Being in the casino business, I had a lot of friends that and casinos I had previously worked at that had restaurants that were friendly to me and helped me out getting going, speaking of relationships. You'll have a wine out there after the session called Lucky. Could the branding be any more obvious on that one? That's our proprietary red wine. When you're small, I mean, the biggest problem the last couple of years has been just not having enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, we sell out of our white blend and our red blend, we sold out of the first 2-3 months after we released it. So it's there and it's gone.
How about you, Sasha?
So we sell direct, so mailing list. We have also several placements in restaurants. We have a wine broker rep in San Francisco who also covers Napa and Sonoma and parts of Marin. So that increases our local footprint. And then we've had a couple restaurants ask us, yeah, we really like your Viognier. Would you do it by keg? And so, you know,
it's great.
We have a couple kegs ready as of last Monday. So
it'll be. And Catherine, the keg thing is certainly a new aspect for you guys too,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's really exciting for us. We've had a restaurant that approached us. They got a new tap system in place and wanted our wine in kegs. They were carrying it by the glass out of the bottle. And so that's been exciting to work with.
And why is that better for you and the drinkers in general?
Well, the bottom line is there's less waste and there's less cost involved. So if we don't have to spend the money on packaging, the bottles, the corks, the labels, the capsules, we can pass those savings on to the restaurant, who can pass it on to the customer. Mm-hmm. For me personally, it's more about the waste. I mean, when a restaurant serves wine by the glass, they just go through dozens of bottles every night, and there's really no need when you can do the reusable keg. And we've found it's preserved very well. There's inert gas in there that keeps oxygen out, and it's working great for us.
So no more stale wines by the glass when you go to the bar?
Yeah.
There's been a real large explosion of urban wineries across the country. I think there's wine in every state now. And the U.S. just surpassed France as the biggest wine-consuming nation in the world this year. Not per capita. We're still far behind them, but we're doing our part. I'm trying.
Yeah.
But there was a big growth of the Garistas, the French version of the urban wineries in the 80s and 90s, and that sort of faded out. People said that movement's dead. That was more a little tied to a style of winemaking, but you saw brew pubs, micro brew pubs pop up in the 80s here in the U.S., and that sort of faded away as well. What's your take on the future for urban wineries? Is this something that's coming in because consumers in the recession are coming out of it are looking for more local, cheaper versions, or something that's kind of here to stay? What's your general take? We'll start with you, Jim.
Yeah, I think actually the trend here is going to be continue and probably grow. And just to rewind back, prior to Prohibition, most wineries in the West Coast in California were actually in urban environments. They brought the fruit in just like we do, just exactly what we do, because the market's close to they made the winery close to the marketplace. And actually, I think that's we've now come full circle, because after Prohibition, they intentionally pushed the wineries out to where they're growing the grapes for control sake. But now we're coming back, and I think the reality is I think people are. I think the consumer is looking for a little bit more intimate relationship with the winemaker. And also, more importantly, I think, as many of you probably all know, is that there's been a consolidation within the wine business, that a lot of the brands that you all are probably aware of in the grocery stores and what have you are being bought up by bigger consolidated brands. And as such, there's a certain homogenization going on in the wine business. And people are looking for the artisanal wines, the wines that are a little bit unique, like we all make. And I think that's the reason why I'm pretty bullish on the fact that I think urban wineries are going to be around to stay, particularly the ones that are passionate, the ones that are doing high quality and trying to keep the price point not low, but in a reasonable place. So it's an attainable luxury, as we like to call ourselves. It's very much an attainable and affordable luxury. So, again, I'm very bullish on the urban winery scene going forward.
How about you, Derek? Are you bullish as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Buy. Call your brokers. Brian, I love your microbrew analogy. I'd kind of marry that up with the passion that's come up a couple times, that word. I think this is where the passion and the energy to me, in this industry really is the small producer, the passionate producer, the person that's doing something a little bit different. And being an urban winery is one way you can be different. It's not the only way, obviously, but it's one way you can be different in this business. I'm inspired to buy wine and to search out wine from smaller producers. Jim mentioned the consolidation and the corporatization of wine. I tend to get away from that a little bit. And I'm also inspired by other people. I mean, we talked about relationships with farmers and the vineyard owners. I've established relationships with – I just met these two tonight. We'll have a relationship after tonight. I've really been inspired by what Jeff Brinkman and Kevin Harvey are doing up at Reese up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, just to give them a little plug. They serve as kind of inspiration for me. Not that I do or can do what they're doing up there, but they're doing a lot of really cool things, you know, be it finding balance at lower alcohol levels or growing grapes in cooler climates than they might have been grown at before. And I think those outlier operations, whether they're urban wineries or whether they're more traditional winery like Reese, it's really exciting to see, to search those types of wineries out for me.
How about you, Sasha?
Yeah, as one of the founding members of the East Bay Vintners Alliance across the way here, we've seen year over year growth in terms of membership and interest. We just had the Passport event, had well over 800 people.
That was sold out, right?
It was sold out, yeah. And every year there are more and more wineries that join, and part of it is because they're established brands, let's say Rosenbloom or J.C. Sellers or Dash. People work a harvest. They get the wine bug. They fall in love. They want to make their own barrel. They do. They put in their garage or crawl space or, you know, wherever you guys have space, you know, you can put something there, so long as it's good temperature control. But, you know, people get the bug. They buy their first barrel. The first barrel is a three-year commitment because they're going to watch the oak diminish, and people get into it, and that passion gets fueled, and then they want to start their own brand. And so every year people sort of splinter off, whether it's off of a donkey and a goat, or I work obviously at Eno. We have some folks that help us. David Teixeira, who's one of our assistants, he's starting his own brand. Ultimately, and some other folks that join us as well. And so it's this contagious thing, mm-hmm. and I think you'll see every year, my prediction is 15 to 30% growth.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going year over year. That's
so not a fad, Catherine? You've been doing pretty well over there. You've been growing every year?
This is the last year.
Yeah. It's over.
It's over. We're done. No, it's definitely growing. Mm-hmm. People catch the bug. Mm-hmm. They want to do it too. And if for no other reason, it's out of selfishness from the winemakers. I love living in the East Bay, and we're staying here to make it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty fun to be able to take Bart to a winery on a weekend and kind of walk around Jekyll and Square tasting or Treasure Island and have fun. But let's be honest, if you suddenly won the lottery or, you know, did an IPO for your tech company, would you be looking to buy a big plot in Napa or Sonoma? Jim, you want to start that one?
No.
No? Okay.
And here's the thing, and actually I get asked this quite a bit. And I think you guys would probably agree with me, but I won't speak for you. But making wine and selling wine is one business. Being a grower and a farmer is another business. I like to say I'm the chef. I'm not a farmer. Mm-hmm. I actually take the ingredients that the growers so you know they live with these vines, they nurture them, and then we take it over and then we do our magic as well. I think I would not want to go in to be a grower, and I think a lot of growers don't want to have anything to do with the wine making the wine business and making and doing the selling and marketing. So no, I think if I came upon some more money, I would probably build out my winery with a little bit bigger equipment and mm-hmm. do some other things with
kick
it.
Kick Derek out. You know,
come over.
Wow. But that's essentially so. No, I think there's two fundamentally different types of business, and having the vineyard doesn't necessarily, and having a state vineyard does not necessarily directly relate to creating some great mm-hmm. wines, because again, the where you grow the grapes is so fickle, and it's something that I'm not a grower and I will probably mm-hmm. never be a grower.
But I mean, Derek, isn't as you have relationships with these growers, you know, and you work with them, you walk their vineyards and you become sort of a part of their family, isn't there a sort of a desire to see that as an area you want to be closer to and to make your wines, or is it important to have a separation and be working stuff in the city still?
Yeah. For now, I'm happy being an urban winery located in an urban environment. I think eventually, in the distant future, I might eventually like to have a plot of land.
Mm-hmm.
I make wine, like Sasha said before, honestly, the wines I make them for my palate. I make wines I like to make. I make them in a style I believe in or I like to make. I want to do a shout out. Danny Sullivan, our assistant winemaker, is at the back of the room back there. And he hi, Danny. He's been known to call me an acid freak, which I think is a compliment.
Which is
right?
Not
a compliment. That's a compliment.
You might have to explain that one a little bit. You might want to.
And the only reason I do that other than to try to embarrass Danny, the only reason I bring that up is that I really believe in making wines that are for the dinner table, mm-hmm. that go with food. And I know Robert Mondavi and a lot of people have been, you know, beating that drum for a long time. But I think it's important, you know, to make wines that are balanced, that are food friendly. Mm-hmm. That's what we do. Right now, I'm learning, working with different vineyards, which varietals, which types of wines I like to make more than others, which ones I seem to have success with mm-hmm. more than others. But to guess it in 20 or 30 years, you know, what wines I'd like to make on an estate vineyard, mm-hmm. for instance, I'm not even close to that yet.
Yeah,
and I'm not real worried about that.
Okay. Sasha, is there a desire to have your name on a vineyard at some point? This is, you know, your family vineyard estate?
I doubt it.
No?
No. I wouldn't mind having a little house at each one of these vineyards because grapes tend to grow in beautiful places. You know, they're not known to grow in Detroit or any place like that. So, you know, conveniently at Santa Barbara or Anderson Valley. I mean, these are some pretty stunning places. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't mind a small little place, but yeah, if you have good relationships with the growers, they typically have something and they're like, oh yeah, come on up, bring the family, you know, so you can get that out. But I really like where I'm at.
Okay. Just a heads up, we're going to do questions in 5 minutes. So if you want to start lining up by the microphone, we'll be doing that in a few minutes. Catherine, some dream plot in Napa at some point in your future? Or?
Well, I can't speak for my husband. He's not here. But we pretty much have our hands full, just the winemaking part right now. So buying a vineyard is not in our immediate plans, no. If we stumbled upon a small fortune, it's beautiful up in wine-growing country. So a small house on a vineyard would be nice, but as far as purchasing a vineyard and going all out that way, that's not in our near-term future.
So one of the things I noticed, well, we talked earlier about the kegs. Other innovations I've seen recently at the East Bay Vendors Alliance tasting was you could bring a beer growler in to get filled up with some local wine. So what other kind of fun innovations are you seeing you guys are trying to do to maybe do something different than what you commonly see among wineries? Do you want to start, Catherine?
Sure, and giving shout-outs. Urban Legend, who's going to be pouring later, just started a new program, and they can talk more about it to you face-to-face. But these growlers, they're like jugs that you purchase once and fill with wine on tap and take it home, drink it, and then bring it back for a refill. Again, less waste, which is what I'm looking for in my book. We haven't tried that yet, and I'd love to hear from Urban Legend how that works for them. But programs like that, I would really be interested in learning more about.
How about you, Sasha? Any kind of innovative packaging or trends you're seeing that's kind of cool, different?
Well, I guess philosophically, we went the route of corks, and then we did synthetic corks, and now we're at screw caps, and who knows where that will take us. It could take us to, I don't know about the Capri Sun kind of things. That's a little much, but I'm always out there trying to push that because I think, consumers are ready. If they're willing to have a growler or have wine from a keg, I just think it's amount of time that we sort of shed some of the traditions and we truly innovate with that. So I'm trying to think what would work well. Some good innovations. I don't know. Maybe just a spigot at people's house. You can have a direct line to Eno Wines, and that'd be always
So, Derek,
true
any
house wine?
Any slot side wine jugs for you at casinos? Can we work that into Vegas with your connections?
Who have you been talking to? I'm working on a jug wine project.
Oh, you
right
are?
Now
okay.
On the side. Being a marketing person, I'm doing the marketing piece first, and the wine will, hopefully in the next couple of few years, we'll have the wine produced to feed that project. So jug wine is in our future. We don't take ourselves too seriously, obviously, if we're making a jug wine. I think the growler concept is great. I think keg wine is great. I think it's really interesting to see how much the industry is coming full circle. I remember one of the first times I went up to Napa, I went to Biale. And they have a black chicken crossing sign for any of you who have ever been there. So I, of course, asked, where's the black chicken? And they said, well, that's the old code word. When you used to call on the party line because the operator could listen in, you'd say, I want three black chicken, And that was like how you'd pick up your jug wine. You bring your empties and you'd pick up your full ones, right? And this goes back, generations. So it seems like a new trend, the growler, but it's really just harkening back to yesteryear.
Yeah. So Jim, any experiments with spigots at your Treasure Island?
Yeah, actually, I'm actually wanted to go into the growler kind of model because I think that's a kind of since we're close, it's kind of you bring people back and getting their repeat business. But the other thing I just want to mention that I heard from Sasha, you're from Michigan, so
yep.
I grew up in Jackson.
There we go.
So I think one thing that you all should take away, if you're from Michigan, you grow up drinking beer. And then you move out to California, you get hit with the wine bug. So that's how it happened to me. So it's sort of interesting that we both had that. I didn't know that. So.
Mm-hmm. Any questions, anyone? Great.
This may be a very naive question, but I've been listening to you all talk. It's a fascinating conversation, but is this a hobby or a business?
That's a very good question. Jim, you want to start since you have the...
Actually, that is a great question. And I started Treasure Island Wines with the intent to create a business. And the reason, just give you a sense, is if you were here earlier, I said we're a collective of several wineries. I have a 10,000-square-foot winery that I needed to figure out how to make some money on and not sink millions of dollars into it and as a hobby. So what we did is that I created this model of an incubator for people like Derek, and a few other ones that they would essentially become bonded wineries within wineries. They actually do that. So in my case, just to brag a little bit, we went cash flow positive within 1 year. Now, am I making lots of money? No. But the issue is I'm not throwing lots of money away. Could I use some other equipment? Could I step it up? I'm looking to do that as well, but at a very organic and consistent rate, so I don't overinvest and underdeliver. So in my case, I chose to go at this at a very business-like manner to make sure that I didn't make a lot of mistakes that other small wineries do, which is invest huge amounts in equipment and inventory and then only find themselves in a cash flow problem later on down the road. So in my case, I did. This is not a hobby. This is passion, but I'm also running it like a business as well.
Next question?
Yes. I want to know how much sulfur do you use? In the process, many wineries have controlled fermentation by killing the natural yeast and then putting in a greater amount of yeast, and then they use sulfur to sterilize. Well,
it's a good question. Overall, we're seeing wineries looking toward biodynamics, which is an extreme form of organics. They're looking to use native yeast. And sulfur certainly has been an issue. There's actually a similar amount of sulfur that's actually like in most fruits and vegetables, but people do think there's a connection between that and headaches. What's your general take on that, Sasha? What's your take on kind of how you make wine in the natural process?
Well, we do add sulfur, partially because wine is a perishable good. If you didn't have it, it happens naturally, as you mentioned. But if you didn't add a little bit, wines wouldn't really be able to age. They would just sort of disintegrate, depending on their acid levels. But we maintain things really quite low. We're probably in the neighborhood of 20 parts per million. I know that doesn't mean stuff to you necessarily, but I mean, it's not a lot. Several folks use a lot more, in the neighborhood of 100 or more, trying to control that. And the industrial wines are certainly much higher, and that's probably where some of the headaches could come from. But there is also a misnomer with attributing it to the sulfites. It also can come from the histamines. So the test that I always give people is go to Trader Joe's. You see the apricots. You see the Turkish ones that are bright orange, and then the ones that are really brown. And the bright orange ones are the ones that have sulfites in it. That's 100x of what's typically in wine. If you have a reaction to those, it's sulfites. If you don't, then it's something else. So many of my friends have tried that, and they walk away saying, give me some more red wine.
I think it's time for one more question. One more? Okay.
Oh, I just wonder, since you deal with many different growers, do you notice the difference between sustainable, organic, and biodynamic when you buy the fruit, or do you seek out one versus the other, and what you're feeling about that controversy between the three, sustainable, organic, and biodynamic?
That's a great question, because organic wines can have sulfites in it, correct? And there are different levels of sustainability. So, Catherine, what's your experience on how you kind of go about choosing the kind of grapes you buy?
Well, our philosophy is the more attention you pay to the vineyards, the better the fruit's going to be. So whether it's biodynamic, organic, or sustainable, just the fact that they're paying attention to them brings up the quality level. Our three vineyards that we work with are all sustainable, which means they have a variety of crops and produce that they grow on their property. They have one vineyard has sheep that he uses to go and mow the weeds in between the rows rather than herbicides. Owl boxes are about the vineyard. We're mostly sustainable at this point. Organic vineyards are harder to find. They're out there. I think there's going to be more in the future, but there's very few right now that we've been able to get fruit from.
How about you, Derek? I mean, you work with one particular farmer we both know very well. I think she's sort of trying to go more that direction, but what's your general sense? Can you say to the farmer you work with, hey, I want you to do this with your vineyard, or do you try to have a hands-off approach to how they grow their grapes?
Yeah, I think once you establish that relationship and work with them year in, year out, you definitely can have more input. And I agree that organic and there's a trend in that direction. I will say, though, that some of the older farmers in the past generations, they don't fully subscribe, especially to biodynamics or maybe even organic. The reality is they tend to farm their farms pretty sustainably, and they don't add a lot of stuff just to add a lot of stuff. I mean, it's been in the family a long time, and they want to take care of it. They want it to be there for generations down the road.
It's their land. They're not trying to destroy their
own. They don't want to poison their own.
I mean, so
poison but the well, right? I mean,
it's often,
that would make no sense.
You know, competing desires. So that an old-time farmer wants to get the biggest crop per year he can for the most money. But, you know, a lot of winemakers want reduced yields. They get the more intense grapes. So, you know, a lot of times I think now what grape growers or winemakers are paying farmers to just to reduce the amount. But yeah, it is their land. It's their family's land. They want to probably do the best they can with it. So,
from a marketing standpoint, too, if I could just speak to that point, I think there's been I don't have my own farm, but there's been a lot of confusion or disconnect between the market and the farmers, just because there's so many different types of sustainable labeling and organic and biodynamic, and I don't know. I mean, do any of you buy only biodynamic wine? Can you raise your hand if you buy only biodynamic wine? So, I mean, if you look at it from a market standpoint, I mean, it might mean something, and it might be cool, and it might be something that's gaining traction, but I don't know that the demand's there enough for a farmer to go out and spend X, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to be able to call their fruit biodynamic. So I think there's an economic reality and a market reality that will slow whatever's about to happen, but there are good reasons for organic and biodynamism to increase over time.
Okay. Next question?
Yeah, I have a question about varietals. So I think that young people tend to know maybe the Cab, the Merlot, the Chardonnay, maybe the Syrah, and you know maybe a Malbec. Can you tell us about a favorite varietal that I don't know about that I should know?
That's a good question. Yeah, you want to start, Jim?
I just made a Roussanne that most people are. It's a Rhone varietal. It's a very nice white wine. That's really, really nice. And again, that's one that we're introducing to a lot of people. And also one of my favorites that is not well known, at least here in California, is a Malbecs. And frankly, Malbecs are one of my favorites, and they're now growing. They're growing some here in California, and I'm eager to get my hands on some and to make some really good Malbecs. So those are the two that I would say, if you haven't tried them, give them a try.
Derek?
We're having some fun with a white blend that we do by utilizing a bit of Viognier, and that's kind of new for us last year. So that's a name that you don't always see on a bottle of wine that I'd throw out there. The other thing I'd say just beyond varietals is I'm finding more and more interesting wines the cooler climate growing region you can get them from. So it might be the same varietal you've always had, like a Syrah, for instance, but if you get it from a really cool growing region, it's almost like trying a new wine. You know, so rather than just be so varietally focused, drill one level down and try to find some really cool vineyard sites or areas, and I think you'll be amazed by what you find there.
How about you, Sasha? Any kind of interesting varietals you're making?
Well, one of my favorites is Grenache, and it has been grown in California. Had sort of a bad rap, and I think more and more growers are planting it in the right places, using the right clones. And I think it's one of the most exceptional wines in the world. This Chateau Neuf du Pape is my number one wine. So it's the most hedonistic grape on the planet. I tend to like that and pleasure, and it's all there for me. So if you can find a good Grenache, I'd go for that. Viognier ain't bad either. So.
And Catherine, are you solely focused on Pinots, or do you expand beyond that?
Yes, we make Pinot, and Pinot. That's our passion. That's what we like to drink. However, we are going to expand into unknown varietals one day.
Do tell.
Well, based on our family history, we'd like to maybe try a Muscat. That's the wine. That's the grape that Uzi's, my husband's grandmother, grew and made. It was a sweet Muscat. However, you can make it dry, and it would be fun to make a dry and a sweet Muscat.
Mm-hmm. Great. So. question?
Yeah. What about through your marketing efforts, like things like this and all the other marketing things you do, the demand grew so much for your wine that you couldn't produce what you needed to? What would you be able to handle that?
That's a good problem to have.
Sign me up.
You just go on to next year. There's always next year. Just make more next year.
Raise the price?
What would we do?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Could you handle it?
Could we handle it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we're all fueled by passion. So it's like, what kind of capacity can your passion hold? So,
but how big of spaces do you work? I mean, really,
how big and how fast can you grow if the demand suddenly?
It's exploded. You know, it is an interesting business where you just can't like triple your production of widget X like in a month. Just throw a lot of money at it and triple it, right? I mean, there's the fruit that has to come in, which happens once a year. It's on a cycle that we can't control and wouldn't if we even wanted to. And we are space constrained. We were talking about that a little bit before we came up on stage about space constraints and growth and equipment. And there's lots of things that make you grow organically. But I think all of us are happy starting small and growing organically. I have that impression, I think. So.
And just a plug for Sasha's Eno Pino. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Just want to read a quick reminder for the radio audience. This is I found my pages here. This is part of the Commonwealth Inform Forum, and we are talking about uncorking the urban wine scene. So I guess kind of following the last question, Catherine, we were talking beforehand about how with the economy there were fewer wines that are being made and there were more grape contracts available to purchase. How do you did you get calls from people saying they offering you grapes that you couldn't have access to before?
We did, yes. I think in Sonoma, they're not exactly long-term contracts like you find in Napa. So they're sort of renewed year to year, and typically we renew ours. But when the economy crashed, I think in 2009, many wineries, say, dropped their Pinot program because it's an expensive wine to make and buy. So there was some extra fruit available sort of at the last minute right before harvest, and there were vineyards scrambling to... In fact, there were many vineyards, I think, that never found buyers, not necessarily Pinot, but I heard of many other vineyards that, I mean, the fruit just dropped.
I'd just add that, I don't know if you guys experience this, but I think from the scale that we work at, we actually have an advantage that, frankly, I don't think is well known, because we typically will buy small lots, three, four, five tons, which a large winery won't even spin up their line to even do because it's not worth it for them. But for us, that's kind of our sweet spot. So we actually have an advantage of going into some, I don't know if you guys have experiences, but we actually can go in and buy the small lots. And because they can work directly with us, we're not at a disadvantage. We actually have an advantage because we're nimble and we can take the small lots that maybe big wineries won't be able to handle. So I don't know if you've encountered that as well.
And the grape growers want to taste that, right?
That's right.
Because if it just gets blended into the Napa Valley cab, they have no idea. And they've been working a lot this year trying to dial things in and want to know if their experiments worked. And they're developing and have an intimate connection with the land. So if they have someone who's making X amount of barrels that they can come over when ML or malolactic fermentation is done and the wine is showing its truer personality, it's great for them. And they're taking notes just as much as you're taking notes when you're in the vineyard. So it's a great relationship that I think we have, or a great advantage that we have too.
Well, we're almost done, but I want to hear a little bit before we go to the wine tasting. What are you guys pouring tonight? What can you tell us a little bit about the wine you're pouring? Get us our appetites up for it. Catherine, you want to start?
I'm pouring our three new releases. They're 2009 Pinot Noirs, all single vineyard designate. I have one from Russian River, Lauterbach Hill Vineyard. We have a Carneros from Barasini Vineyard and Corona Creek Vineyard, which is in the Sonoma Coast.
So we're pouring a Pinot Noir from 2007, and we may, depending on how the night goes, 2008. We have 2007 Grenache from Eagle Point Ranch, which is up in Mendocino. We also have an Old Vine Zinfandel from Dry Creek, and that's 2008, and a 2008 a Cool Climate Syrah from Carneros.
So, Derek, you said you're an acid head earlier on. Can you explain that a little bit in context of wine?
Acid freak.
Yeah, acid freak, yeah. Acid head, that's fine. So, yeah, that's a fair segue to what we're pouring tonight. So,
oh, really?
A little bit. So we're pouring a white wine to start, a Chardonnay from Carneros, from the Thompson Vineyard. And it's not your typical California Chardonnay, which means it's not oaky and it's not buttery. It's not oaky because we use very little new French oak on the wine. And it's not buttery because it doesn't go through the malolactic fermentation that Sasha just referenced. So it's more of the acid shines through, that malic acid, that natural acid that the fruit comes in with, shines through and makes it what I would consider a food wine. As far as the red wines we're pouring our outlier Pinot Noir from Santa Cruz Mountains, 2008 vintage. We're pouring our Lucky Red Blend, which is a non-vintage wine. So you can try to figure out what what year the fruit came from. And that one is sold out, so just brought out. We had an extra case at the winery, and we brought it out for you guys tonight. So you're tasting something that really doesn't exist anymore. And then the last one is the Midnight Oil Syrah, which comes from Santa Lucia Highlands. Again, a very cool climate Syrah, and 2007 vintage on that one.
Great. And Jim, how about you? What are you pouring tonight?
Actually, I have to catch a plane to Europe, so I'm going to get out of here. But Derek here is
member. I brought a lot of wine.
He brought lots of wine.
More than you can drink.
He's part of the team, and he's going to represent us well. So, but I'd encourage you all to come out to Treasure Island Wines to sample our stuff. We actually have quite a few interesting varietals and different styles. So.
Great. Well, now for the hard stuff. In the newly founded Informed tradition of 2011, that we are asking all of our speakers the following question. So Jim, Derek, Sasha, and Catherine, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world? Jim, start with you.
Oh. So for the record, they told us they were going to ask us this question 5 minutes before we walked on stage.
Yeah.
And we are all scratching our heads. Actually,
I don't have to answer. It's great.
Yeah, somebody in high tech, seriously, turn off your cell phones, turn off your iPhones, and have a glass of wine and take a look around. We live in an incredibly beautiful place, seriously. So that would be, that's mine.
Okay.
Next.
Yeah,
victim.
Derek, you want to?
So I'll go off of something I said earlier. I just encourage everyone to find something you're passionate about, read as much about it as you can, learn as much about it as you can, and the rest will take care of itself. Some path will be laid out before you. So passion, read, do. That would be my three words.
Sasha?
And all of that's contagious. I think passion is contagious. So it's great to be around such passionate folks, and you feel that. So one thing, I guess I'll be a little more specific in an idea that I have. It's an idea that I had in high school, so temperate with that. I don't think my frontal lobe was fully developed then, but it's combining. My grandmother lived to be 95, and she told amazing stories, and I would just sit there enraptured with her life story, whether it was the Second World War, raising three kids in the Netherlands, what that was like alone. But I always wanted people to connect to stories, and so I thought, wouldn't it be amazing of a four-year-old to connect 80-year-old folks, maybe 90-year-old folks, so like a nursing home with a nursery school, and they're telling stories of their actual lives, not reading books. And you could record that, and then the kids could do nice little paintings. My daughter loves to draw, and that would be a gift that they would give. And so it would be sort of this whole cycle of life. So, like I said, high school idea. So, cut me some slack.
How about you, Catherine?
I would say conserve. We did something as simple as participating in, I think it was called Earth Hour, a couple weekends ago. Our family, we turned off the lights from 8 to 9 at night, and it was just an hour, but besides conserving a little bit of energy, it was nice family time. The kids, you know, had to turn off the TV as well and no computers, and we just had a simple hour of family time.
So. Great. Well, let's get a round of applause to our panelists here. Now this meeting of the Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.